Noguchi up with Patalainen. Here's Richardson. It's a great goal for Aberdeen. Giugani Galli, totally helpless. It's an astonishing strike by Richardson. The 13th minute of the match, and it's unlucky for Torino. It's Richardson's fourth goal of the season, but unquestionably his best.
Welcome to the latest By the Minute Aberdeen podcast. Now, becoming a cult hero is a curious thing. It tends to place very little relevance on how many games a player might have played or medals they might have won. Consider, for example, Zoltan Varga's 31 games during an otherwise unremarkable early 70s season. Or maybe Hisham Ziriali's 48 appearances during some of the club's poorest seasons. Today's guest definitely left an impact at Pittodrie, despite only being here for two seasons. So much so that he joined that small band of ex-players who are known and understood by just a single name. Fellow Dons fans will know exactly who you mean if you say Willie, or Theo, or Ian. And they'll also know the man we have in conversation today, Rico. Lee, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Richard. Yes, nice to speak to you.
Well, let's take you right back to the start then, Lee. A child of the 70s, what were your early football memories?
playing outside where I lived, we had like a moor, you know, lots of football pitches and rugby pitches, and probably from the age of about five, I would expect, there's a gang of lads who were, most of them were older than me, and my elder brother and myself, and then couple of few years later, my younger brother, we'd always play out, and I was obviously a different era then, going back into the dark ages when children played outside and didn't come in till it was dark, and that's what I used to do and play football, you know, in the main.
And what about a childhood hero? Whose photo was on your wall? Who do you mould yourself after?
Well, I think Glenn Hoddle was probably, in terms of my position, he was the one player I really kind of admired. I say one player, there's others, people like Graeme Souness, I thought was an excellent player, all-round midfield player. Those were probably the two that stand out. There were local players who played for Halifax Town, because I used to go and watch Halifax Town when I was a kid. My dad used to take us all down there, so there were players who came through the ranks at Halifax. One was Scott Paul Hendry, who was Lee Hendry's dad.
Mm-hmm.
He was a really good Tigerish midfield player. Maradona, of course, you know, and some of the other people like Ken Laglish. These were all players who you looked up to and thought were great, and were great, you know. There's enough there, isn't there, I think.
Well, let's actually speak about Halifax, because you came up through the ranks there.
Yeah.
I take it was a very good grounding, was it?
Yeah, in many ways. I mean, the eras were different, you know. There were no academies. I think it was myself and my brother and a few of the local teams were invited to send players down for a kind of training week by the then youth coach, a guy called Jerry Brook. And that was kind of the start of it for me. So he probably picked me out of amongst the crowd then. And we kind of kept getting invited back in the school holidays. In the meantime, I was sort of playing for school teams and local Sunday teams and you know, obviously doing quite well. Eventually, was offered sort of apprenticeship terms at Halifax when I was leaving school. There was a couple of, I think, Bradford City and Sheffield Wednesday were kind of other potentials, but it was always in my mind that we'd sort of just start at Halifax because it was a clearer path or I thought it was a quicker potential opportunity to get into the first team, which is what happened. Yeah, so we had quite a good crop of lads coming through at that time. A guy called Wayne Allison who had a long career. I played with three clubs. He was in the same sort of year group as me, and we came through together and got broke into the Halifax Town team. at quite a young age. I think I was 17 when I made my debut, and that was that. So that was the platform. But it was a good ground in the sense that, yeah, I had that clear-ish pathway. I mean, even the lower levels now, it's hard for players to break into the team, I think, and especially with since the inception of the playoffs. Obviously, nearly every team in the division is playing for something all the way through the season, whereas when I first started, it was, you know, promotion and a couple of teams looking at the bottom. And it seems to me there were a good half a dozen, maybe more teams that were, you know, with 10 games to go, had nothing to play for. So that was a good opportunity for clubs to club youngsters like myself, you know.
I mean, that sadly, it was still a pretty competitive league. So do you think that playing so young in such a competitive man's league, if you will, moulded you into the type of player that you became?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things like I say, it was interesting because obviously Glenn Hoddle was a bit of a role model. I remember my first manager, a guy called Mick Jones, he basically held up Brian Robson as the benchmark of the midfield players and said that, you know, I could obviously pass the ball and I could do the other side of it, but at the time probably I was not as consistent with that. I mean, consistency is the key for all players, and for a midfield player to do both sides of the game, if you like, to attack with creativity and you know, quality, and to be able to defend and stop the opposition playing is the hallmark of a great midfield player. And that was kind of expressed to me from that sort of age time frame. So I could certainly do both, but when I did both consistently well, that's when I was at my best, you know. And I think that was true all the way through my career. So yeah, it was more the demands at that time. The game was much more physical than it is now.
Yeah.
Without being overly dramatic, to basically kick your opposing number before he got you. That was the kind of idea. You had to sort of impose yourself physically on the opposition. That was what it was. And in fact, funnily enough, I was watching a couple of really old clips from Halifax Town, not games that I played in, but a couple of other games a few weeks ago, and the tackles that went in.
Yeah.
You know, players would now be banned for life for some of the tackles that were just not even looked at in those days. So it was a different era. And I suppose it did provide me with training, if you like, in the dark arts.
Yeah, different sport entirely. You watch those little videos sometimes, different sport, it seems. Mm. We don't want to play too much into what became a bit of a tabloid caricature of you, because anyone who watched you playing for their sides will know that you could do the whole range of the midfield skills. A great passer of the ball and a tremendous goal-scoring record, which we'll come on to later on as well. Not just for us, but laterally at Oldham too. So after Halifax, you moved on to Watford and then to Blackburn. Now, you're at Blackburn when Jack Walker started to throw money about, started to invest heavily, and brought in Kenny Dalglish. Now, obviously, that's a kind of double-edged sword for you, because the free spending there did ultimately curtail your career at Ewood Park. But what was it like in those early days under Kenny?
It was, looking back, obviously, the transformation of football, really, when Jack came into Blackburn. Although, actually, he'd actually been involved at Blackburn, unbeknownst to most people, for a few years before that.
Okay.
I think he was behind Ozzy Ardiles and Steve Archibald going to the club. I think he was regularly sort of investing in the club quietly behind the scenes. He actually paid for the money that bought me to go to Blackburn. But when he kind of really came in all guns blazing, that's when he really did transform. And obviously Kenny was pretty much the turning point there. And in actual fact, to be fair to Kenny, I'd played a lot of games for Blackburn. And when he came in, I played a few games initially for him. But as the club was getting more and more money, they were signing players left, right and centre. I still managed to play a part in the squad, and actually my last game for Blackburn was coming on as sub in the playoff final at Wembley, where we got promotion. There was no sense from Kenny that I had to leave Blackburn. He was very happy to have me in the squad, and, you know, was very, very democratic, as a manager and coach. You know, he didn't, obviously every manager and coach has sort of players who they rely on, you could argue, with sort of favours, but it was more that I had sort of got used to playing a lot of football.
Mm-hmm.
At Halifax, I played sort of 90 games before I left, but by the time of 19. At Watford, I think I played, you know, 50 games, something like that. You know, even at Blackburn, I'd played maybe 50, 60 games before Kenny got there, so I was used to playing. And my attitude was not the right one at the time. Squad football just hadn't happened. you know, squad football was, most squads had like 16 to 18 players.
Yeah.
And that was it. And when, what happened with us was we were quickly amassing more and more players. I wanted to play and I wanted to sort of be regular in the team, which, you know, looking back again, it's probably, although it was a great experience and I don't regret going to Aberdeen, sometimes it is, you know, you obviously look back and think, well, maybe I could have stayed there a little bit longer and fought for a place and been playing in the Premiership, which, you know, it's all ifs and buts. But that was my recollection of Kenny coming in was of someone who was a bit of a hero, and it was also quite hard there was a bit of an unreality about it for all of us. You know, we'd gone from being Blackburn Rovers, they used to call us kind of rag Rovers or rag ass Rovers, and we'd gone from that to the BBC News was talking about us on the Saturday night. I just remember Moira Stewart introducing, talking about Blackburn Rovers. So we'd gone from being just a run-of-the-mill team, if you like, to being like high profile. And we obviously found it, I think all of us found it a little bit of a challenge to adapt at first. But to be fair to Kenny, he was a great guy. And I did enjoy, you know, my sort of time with him over a year or so it was that I had with him, you know.
Well, you were signed by Willie Miller in September 1992. Mm-hmm. He'd seen you when he was scouting the magnificent Duncan Hewer, who'd also been surplus to requirements at Blackburn.
Yeah.
What did you know about Aberdeen, or indeed Willie himself, before you signed? And how did he sell the club to you, and what was the attraction of coming north?
It's funny, when I was a kid, I remember you asked me about my early memories of football. One of them was watching Football Focus on a Saturday, or, you know, the Saturday scores, and seeing Archie McPherson coming to life from Pittodrie, and he always looked red raw. He always looked freezing. He always looked like he was windy and cold. And
still is,
you know. And obviously, I remember the cup run with you know, the great Aberdeen team with Fergie in charge, of which Willie was part, and Alec and Alan McLeish, and obviously a few other guys. And they were always, you know, well respected in England. You know, Aberdeen was, with that era, was massively respected, I think, as a team. So when I heard that Aberdeen were interested, initially it was like, oh, that's a long way away. But then it was, actually, no, I quite fancy that. You know, it would be an opportunity. I knew that they were top three or four team in the Scottish Premier. And to be honest, my intention was to go up and have a couple of years and then come back down again. I was quite fixed in that view, that I wanted to just sign a two-year contract, give it my all, and then see what was happening back down the road, and see if I could go on. I'd already been a bit of a gypsy by then anyway. That was my fourth club, so at a relatively young age. I remember coming in on the airport from Dice and down, like driving into the ground, I think I've said this before, and there was a sign on the, oh, someone had sprayed English scum go home, you know, on the one of the on the way into the town centre, which I thought was quite interesting, and thought it kind of appealed to me in some kind of weird way. But Willie was obviously in our minds down the road a top player, even though I don't think he came down to England, did he, Willie? Stayed at Aberdeen all his career.
Yeah, 20 years here, yeah.
So he didn't really, I mean, obviously I was impressed with him as a person and as a manager. I thought he was excellent. He could have, you know, he could have easily had a better career maybe down here had he wanted to do so. Nowadays he would certainly be somebody who would be, he'd probably have had a trip down the road himself as a manager. He was very, very hard at times with certain players, but he was always very fair with me. I think he kind of appreciated that when it came to a Saturday, I pretty much nearly always hopefully give my all, which that's the way I think he should be. So I enjoyed playing for him. I think he was a bit like me. I wasn't the best trainer, I think, in that era, again, against a slight regret looking back. But part of the reason was, I think one of the advantages nowadays players have is the sports science influx, which actually emerged. I think we were at Blackburn, we were one of the first clubs to, Kenny was one of the first people, there's probably people, a lot of people don't know this, but Kenny was one of the first people to involve sports scientists. There's a guy called Eddie Baranowski who came in 1992, I think it'll be, and it was basically, we're like, came in to do the warm-ups and things, and then it spread, you know, for a couple of days a week, and then it became doing some weight gym sessions with them and stuff. And it was the very earliest inception of sports science, and now it's, you know, it's just become an industry. And I think one of the benefits for players is that they're, well, one of the benefits, but one of the actual drawbacks is that they're potentially, they're well looked after and well resourced in terms of all the you know, the science behind recovery and looking after themselves to the extent possibly where it's gone too far and they're a little bit pampered now. But we didn't have that, and we basically, I was very much in the era of work hard, play hard. Saturday night after the game was, you know, was, it was the law that you had a few drinks and, you know, maybe the odd couple on a Sunday, and that was what you did. And then, you know, for me, that probably wasn't the best way to recover from a Saturday. So the first 2 days of the week would be my recovery, and I'd probably get my head back on by Thursday, but then go and do it again. And that's the sort of era that we were brought up in. I got away with that with Willie because hopefully my performances were okay on the Saturday. I think it's okay if that's the case. I think when it becomes a problem for managers is when, you know, that becomes that the performances aren't there. So, but I appreciated that. I think Willie saw that I was the type of, that he was probably like a little bit himself, and I think he recognised that in me. You know.
Now, I don't know if you're one of these guys that has perfect recall of points in his career, but I want to touch specifically on your debut.
Yeah.
For Aberdeen as a sub against Partick Thistle. Now, my memory, it might be deceiving me, but my memory is your first touch after coming on was a crunching tackle in midfield, winning the ball, passing it on to Brian Grant, who then pinged one in the top corner from 25 yards. What are your recollections?
Well, you've done me there because I vaguely remember the game. And I can't remember that, but I'll take your word for it. You obviously saw me do it.
But regardless, you made a very quick start.
Yeah, I actually thought my first game was the Cup semi-final. I thought I came on in that, but you might be right. It might have been that I played in that Partick game, and then we played Celtic in the Cup the next.
Yeah, the next midweek. Right. Yeah.
In my head, it was always Celtic was my debut, but right. You're probably right. It's,
regardless, though, you made a very quick start to your time in Aberdeen. The fans instantly took to you, and you were a regular starter after that debut. Apart from the League Cup final versus Rangers, where Willie started Roy Aiken ahead of you,
right.
You subsequently came off the bench. Do you recall how you reacted when you saw the team and saw that you weren't starting despite having started the last six or seven games?
No, you've probably reminded me vaguely, but I probably accepted it in terms of, you know, Big Roy had been playing prior to that. I don't know what Willie's reasoning for that was, to be honest. I don't know whether it was... To be honest, I really don't know. You've obviously reminded me of something that I've forgotten about, to be honest.
Well, that Cup final was one of quite a few tough losses that we took against what was a very good Rangers team, obviously, year.
The main Cup final I remember was the one I started and scored in.
Yes, later that season, yeah.
I remember, quite vividly, before the game, and one of the reasons actually I got, obviously I'm now, I don't know if you know, I'm a performance or sports psychologist now.
Yeah,
we'll
talk about that later if that's okay.
That's my sort of area, yeah, and that was one of the earliest, not the starting point, but one of the earliest experiences where I started to get me think, you know, more interested in what was going on in the minds of players and the game when I think we played before the game. I remember looking around the dressing room and thinking, actually, the lads look a little bit nervous and too nervous, you know, not like they normally would be.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we did that. Not maybe I was as well. I don't know. I remember observing it in others more than feeling it in myself. We didn't perform anywhere near what we'd perform like in other games and the other games against Rangers. So it was a disappointment, really. And it kind of occurred to me that, you know, you can, it doesn't matter really who the manager is in many ways or what you do, you know, building up to big games. It's those big games that count. And obviously, we've seen that in the European Championships with England, and it's that sort of state control, how players are before and during it, and whether they are in the right sort of, the right mental approach or my mental state. That was the game I remember. The one that you've mentioned there when Roy played instead of me, I'm vaguely recalling, but it's a very distant memory, to be honest.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that first season, because as I say, you endeared yourself to the supporters very, very quickly. I mean, silly little things like when you got your first goal, last minute goal at Dundee, I remember you running to the crowd behind and, you know, again, just making that bond with the supporters. How did you find living up here? And, you know, were you aware, just by talking to people in pubs and things, that you were becoming a bit of a favourite?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like, you know, wasn't something I was set out to do. I just wanted to do my job and I was focused on that task. And that's obviously, you know, looking back, I had quite a build up of energy to expend with the disappointment of it sort of not working out quite as I'd liked at Blackburn. You know, and I definitely left Blackburn with a sense of a point to prove. And so Aberdeen probably benefited from that. And my now wife, Amanda, moved up with me. We lived, we lived Cove Bay, was it?
Mm-hmm.
In a bungalow in Cove Bay, I remember that. We had dogs as well. We had one Labrador, I think, then. And then we moved to a farmhouse on the A92 that comes out of Aberdeen. What's the dual carriageway that comes out of Aberdeen? We lived there. And we kind of lived, you know, quite a rural life when we were there. And then obviously made some friends while we were up there. Loved the city, loved the people, loved the time in general. Obviously some sort of times when particularly my wife Amanda was a bit homesick, and I think that was, you know, as I said earlier, I was fully intending to just have 2 years at Aberdeen and look to try and get back down the road, possibly in the Premiership or whatever. You know, had we have maybe had children or something like that, then it might have been different. Again, it's another regret that I maybe should have stayed at Aberdeen a little bit longer, because moving to Oldham was probably the worst move I ever made for many reasons, even though personally it went well for me.
Yeah.
It was a bad decision in terms of the wrong club, and I should have maybe waited and signed another year or so at Aberdeen and so see what happened. Because I think, as well, the Sky Sports actually came up to Scotland after I came back down, and they seemed to sort of, you know, instill a little bit more interest in Scottish football when I'd sort of been there. When, to be honest, Scottish football, and it's gone a bit back that way now, kind of takes a bit of a backseat to the Premiership and the Championship, you know. And but yeah, my recollections of Aberdeen were very happy ones, really, and a beautiful place, beautiful town, beautiful people, and I certainly enjoyed it. It was just, I think, I had this plan, I had this sort of vision of a 2 year stay, and then I had to, for my career, get back down the road and start playing again, and that's where I was. And with Amanda probably erring on the side of wanting to get back down the road as well, I didn't really even talk to Willie. You know, Willie was keen to, I didn't talk to him. I didn't talk to him about a contract. Willie was keen to sort of try and sign me on again. I think I told him straight and said, Willie, I've made up my mind. I already had when I first came that I want to go. So there was nothing in me leaving Aberdeen that was a slight on Aberdeen in any way. It was just kind of a bloody-minded view that I was going to have 2 years there and then try my luck back again in England, you know.
Yeah, somehow that doesn't surprise me that you were so steadfast and set in your ways there. But, I mean, that side you came into, they played some astonishing football. There was a spell of 13 goals in 4 days in particular. 7-0 versus Partick, 6-2 versus Hearts, that really stand out. I think you touched upon this when it came to what you saw in the dressing room before the cup final.
Yeah.
But why do you think they couldn't quite get over the line when it came to silverware, finishing second in all competitions that season?
I think my own view at the time, and this is not current now, but at the time my view was that there was an element of awe about some of the younger lads who had obviously grown up with Rangers and Celtic as the dominant forces, and that's not the whole thing, but I think it was an element that psychologically that there was a lack of belief that they could be done. I think Willie used to say that. I certainly probably picked up on that. Whether it became a self-fulfilling prophecy, which is obviously something that does happen all the time. I didn't have that. You see, I didn't have any respect in terms of... I respect them as football clubs, but I didn't ever respect them on the pitch, you know. But that, for me, was anti to what we were supposed to do. When I say respect, I mean that we couldn't beat them, you know. I didn't have any lack of belief that we couldn't, if we played as well as we could, that we couldn't beat Rangers or Celtic whenever we played them. I always believed that we could. I remember one game we played against Rangers where I think it was Andy Gorham who had probably the best, the best goalkeeping performance I've ever seen of a player in all my years. I don't think it was surmounted. Where we lost at home 1-0. I think Mark Haley scored the winner, and he was a big. I think we were 6 points off them or something like that, maybe a bit more or a bit less. had we won that game, we'd have come in real contact with it. I think they had to play Celtic a couple, you know, at least once between then and the end of the season. So it was a pivotal game in my mind, and that was probably our best football when I was there, the best performance against Rangers without getting the result. And sometimes that happens, but I think the frustration with the cup final that I'm talking about is the lack of performance, not necessarily the result. I think in terms of the team and why we couldn't manage to win more games against Celtic and Rangers down the road was in large part because of that, because of this a belief that it's difficult and therefore it can't be done.
And that's obviously something that I guess you try and tackle in your current role. And again, we'll come to that later on if that's okay. Mm. The following season brought your first taste of European football. Mm. The game was versus Torino. Again, I'm not sure how much you remember about them, but obviously we were 2-0 up in the away leg. Mm. Took them back to Pittodrie, 3-2 down. It was yesterday, 27 years ago yesterday, that you scored a stunning, stunning goal with your left foot as well. Mm-hmm. Do you remember anything in particular about that? Or?
Yes, I remember the Torino games more than I do some of the others, obviously. The first game against Torino, I remember because I was really ill. I think I had a flu virus or something prior to the game. I was close to not playing. We were over in Torino, and I did feel really, really bad. But I think Willie wanted me to play. He wanted me to mark Benito Carboni. I think that was the role he kind of assigned to myself, or I certainly had to look out for him. So I did feel really really bad in the game and felt terrible, really. I sort of just had to get through it. Remember, we started brilliantly. We scored two goals very quickly. And then conceded a really soft goal just before half-time, I think. They might have even scored both before half-time, I'm not sure. But we'd lost our advantage quite quickly. And then, obviously, we ended up losing the game outright, but still not out of it because we were... Yeah, we were only one goal behind, and then obviously in the back of Pittodrie, again I was obviously dead keen to and believe that we could still beat them. I remember it was quite early on was the goal, wasn't it? It just came out from the clearance from the edge of the box, and I just remember at the time I'd sort of worked out, and a lot of players fall down with this, particularly midfield players. In realising that technique is all that matters when it comes to striking it from the edge of the box. Too many players trying to, you know, smash the hide off the ball without just concentrating on technique. And all I did do with that shot was just to try and concentrate on getting a nice clean strike and just literally concentrate on technique. The fact that it looks like it flies in the net is more because it's a good clean connection. That's the thing. You know, it's when they're on target and they're going to the top corner, that they always look faster than what they really probably are, you know. So more about just concentrating on getting a good technique and a good strike. And it was obviously a good strike. But then, you know, that gave us the 1-0 lead again. And again, we succumbed to two poor goals, I think, before half-time to lose that advantage. I remember the atmosphere was probably one of the best atmospheres I've experienced as a player in a game. You know, I've had several experiences playing at Wembley, playing at, you know, places like St James's Park and Roker Park in England, where the atmospheres are particularly fervent, even Ibrox and Parkhead. But that night at Pittodrie was particularly special, I seem to remember.
Yeah, the big European nights are always quite memorable. It's a shame, in a way, that you weren't able to have more of them in your time up here. Now, during that second season, it did seem that the discipline started to catch up with you. Did you feel that you were a bit of a marked man by the referees up here? Certainly that was the story that was put out in the press when you left the club at the end of that second season.
Yeah, and I do think that did have a bearing on my mood, and it certainly didn't help dissuade me from leaving, because I genuinely felt this. I'm not saying that I never made a bad tackle up in Aberdeen, but I think it was, again, we're going back to that early start in football. I do remember at the time, English football was probably a bit more combative than what I experienced in Scotland. And part of that was the referees seemed to just, possibly because of incidents that happened in the season before. I don't know, but there was certainly. I think I got sent off against. I got sent off against Rangers, which, and it was more for the look of the tackle than actually what happened. It was. I didn't actually make contact with the lad. The shame for me. The problem for me, obviously, nowadays you've got 15 cameras that will pick up every nuance of every tackle, and you can actually see the reality. Sometimes you see a tackle and it looks horrific, and then you look at it again, and the guy's not actually touched any, you know, touched the player. And that's, I think it was Charlie Miller, was it, who got sent off against Rangers. He certainly was ahead of his time when it came to play acting, because I actually didn't touch him. You know, there'll be plenty of other tackles that I made against Rangers that were far worse. And there's no doubt in my mind I suffered from a kind of a knock-on effect. Then I think it was at Hibs I got sent off for two very, very soft tackles and would seem to get booked every time I made a tackle.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably the worst thing. It was like every time I went in for a tackle, whether either, you know, whether it was a foul or not, I seemed to get a booking sometimes when I actually won the ball. So it became very frustrating. I think, to be fair to Willie, I think he acknowledged that. I also, from my own downfall, probably was a bit too open with the press and a bit too naive in terms of some of the headline writers and some of the stories that probably were, you know, attributed to myself at the time probably didn't help. And so, you know, kind of became the pantomime villain for lots of clubs. I remember going away to, you know, when we used to play away then, possibly something to do with the Englishness as well and the long hair. But I used to get quite a bit of stick, which I had in mind. It didn't bother me at all. Apart from Motherwell once, where we got to, I went, Willie put me out wide to sort of play. And I think it might have even been Tommy. Did Tommy Boy play for Motherwell before he played for Celtic? Or did?
Yeah, I think he did, yeah.
Yeah, it might have been Tommy. Was a raiding left back and he wanted to stop him, so I was assigned with that and at Motherwell, and I remember feeling several kind of hits on my body from coins being thrown at me, and I kind of sort of, it started to make me edge slightly inwards. I remember having, I think that was the only time I ever had a bit of a fallout with Willie, was over the fact that I wasn't staying wide. He wanted me to stay wider, and I was getting pelted by coins. I remember jogging around the pitch afterwards for the warm down, and several of us picked up handfuls of coins that were being thrown at us from the side. I remember that. So that was, you know, that was probably a factor in me thinking, well, you know, this is going, you know, beyond the game now. This is, you know, the fans and the referees and my notoriety, if you like, is getting in the way of the football, you know.
So at the end of season 93-94, you made the decision to move on. As we've already said, that was to Oldham. We managed to get in touch with you because of Alex McLeish's son, John. I take it you made some good friends at the club in that 2 years.
At Sabadino, yes. Yeah, everyone, I mean, I enjoyed it. It was some really happy times. Obviously, Big Alex himself, we were good mates. And I remember Jim Bett being a real character, a funny guy, and Robert Connor, you know, Mixu Patalainen, and all the lads, Ian Jess, you know, big Brian Irvine, and all these good guys. They're all some really good lads.
And have you been back up to Aberdeen since?
Yes, I think. And you know what, I think it's once, you know. I came back to see my pal, one of the guys I met while I was up there is a guy called Gordon Smith, who's still a friend to this day. He's a drummer in a band, the local band that I kind of ended up...
One God Universe.
One God Universe, yeah. And they were good mates as well, all the lads in the band, and a guy called Ross Brockie and his brother Ali and Gordon Smith. I think I went back up to Aberdeen to see him or them. And I actually went to the game. I can't remember the game now. We just kind of got tickets. I can't remember how I got the tickets. I don't think I got into the club, but yeah, that was. I'm pretty sure that's the only time I've been back up. There's been a couple of times when I've nearly been up. Once was to play in a game, a testimonial game, but for some reason I couldn't make it. I think I might have said I've only been back once, which is a bit scary, really. But I'd certainly not rule out going back at some point.
Well, there's a former Players Association, Lee. I don't know whether you're in touch with them or, but that's maybe something that you could be in touch with. I'm sure they'd sort you out for tickets if you ever wanted to come north.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, the obviously the season after you left, we got into quite a relegation battle. Was it a surprise for you to see the state of the club, or were you never someone that really kind of looked back after you moved on?
Yeah, no, I do remember. I think there was probably, it was like after, you know, I can't exactly remember, but who left the year I left, but there was probably another couple of players left.
It was quite a wholesale change.
Move on, did Alex retire as well?
Alex moved to Motherwell to become manager, and Jim Bett moved on. And
yeah, so you probably lost quite a bit of experience from that from the dressing room. You know, maybe myself as a midfield player, I don't know whether that had an impact, but when you have that turnover of players, sometimes it's difficult to sort of remould the team and get it firing again. So you probably lost quite a bit of strength of the character out of the dressing room, maybe, I don't know. Obviously, I still do, Chelsea Aberdeen. I was watching the semi-final the other day. I was at Wigan Athletic, where I'd been consulting, and were watching the game with Gary Caldwell, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So I always keep an eye on the results, but I can't remember what happened in terms of the relegation. You probably have more of an idea on that than I do.
Well, there were kind of rumours around here at the end of that season, the season after you left, that there was rumours that you were being lined up for a return. I take it there was no substance in that at all. There was never any chat.
No, to be honest, I can't remember. I mean, I think it may have happened, because I tell you what did happen for me was that I started. Joe Royal was a manager at Oldham, and I think my first game I scored two goals at Oldham, you know, two sort of 20-yard, 30-yard screamers actually, and then scored another couple of goals in the first four games. But apparently Joe had this strategy, I think, of kind of focusing on the new signings and trying to work on their strengths and weaknesses, mainly their weaknesses early doors. And we kind of had one or two disagreements, shall we say, culminating him in sort of taking me off at half time in a game, which I wasn't happy with, because I felt that I was sort of being picked on, if you like, which again, you know, looking back, probably poor attitude from me. But I was quite strong-willed, and I felt there were things that weren't right. We were struggling as a team because we'd just been relegated from the Premier League. The main reason why I agreed to sign for Oldham was that I knew one or two players there. Is close to where I live, from Halifax. In the previous few years, Oldham had a massive success story, which I'd sort of seen from afar, and I quite fancied being a part of. They tried to sign me before, and when I agreed to sign for them, it was sort of quite a few months, because I had an agent at the time, and it was already sort of lined up. There was a couple of other clubs interested, but they were the ones that I'll sign for Oldham. That was clear in my mind. It's a great opportunity. They were mid-table in the Premier League, and then they played in the semi-final against Manchester United, and Mark Hughes equalised in the last minute with a volley when Oldham were winning 1-0 to go into the cup final. And from that, so then subsequently Oldham lost the semi-final. And from that moment, they didn't win another game from then to the end of the season. I think they picked up 3 or 4 points, but they went on a horrific run and ended up getting relegated from a real position of safety. And the deal had already been done, I'd already agreed to sign. So I kind of joined Oldham on a bit of a crest of a slump, you know, and it wasn't a good decision to go. And I knew within a couple of days that I'd made the wrong decision, because the environment, the atmosphere around the place was depressed, you know. It was, I think that affected lots of things. And so Joe Royal actually left within a couple of months of that season. I'd been left out of the team as a consequence of the fallout. Graham Sharp took over and kind of carried that on a little bit for a few weeks, although it didn't last. But and I was kind of not a bad boy, but I was on the periphery, that's for sure. So it may have been at that time that maybe Aberdeen might have inquired, or I don't know. But if they'd have seen that I was out of the team, that might have prompted something. But I can't remember ever being spoken to about it, so you know, I don't know. Maybe so.
Well, you did actually make a return to Scotland briefly after a time at Oldham and Huddersfield.
Yeah.
You pitched up at Livingston for half a dozen games in 2000. How did that come about, first of all?
Basically, just again going back to this, the reason why I say Oldham was probably the worst move was that when you're involved in a team that's struggling, it's almost a perception thing that the team's not doing well, and obviously it reflects on everybody, I suppose is what I'm saying. And whilst it went well for me, I kind of got player of the season every season I was there, I think. You know, things weren't right at the football club, and eventually they got relegated in the last season.
Mm-hmm.
Coincidentally, the Bosman ruling had started, and or was due to start the following season, which was again unfortunate for me because I think I was seen as probably Golden's best player, and they wanted quite a significant amount of money for me. I think they wanted, they'd signed me for £350,000, I think, a fair amount of money for Oldham, but they wanted about $750,000 for me, I think, at the end of that third season, with Bosman not coming in for another 12 months, but everybody knew that Bosman was coming in. And so I was out of contract, but Oldham was still demanding a fee, which put off a few clubs from taking me. I eventually moved to Huddersfield. But I hadn't done a proper pre-season. You know, this is, I know I'm not trying to make excuses here, but these are sort of things that happen in the career.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why I love doing what I do, because I see this sort of thing happening all the time with players. You know, there's little events that can happen, you know, injuries that delay them starting a pre-season or not being with the club and having a struggle with the pre-season. And all these things can contribute to you either not playing at your best or not being taken by a club. And so I eventually went to Huddersfield, again having not had a proper pre-season, just about getting myself fit, doing really well initially. They were bottom of the league, I think, with about 4 or 5 points. So Huddersfield had been top of the league recently. I think the last time that happened was sort of the second season that I was there, but the first season was there. Managed to get in the team and help them turn it around, but then got injured and subsequently seemed to get lots of niggles and lots of injuries. Most players now have their feet checked out by podiatrists. Most of us have an imbalance in our legs. So I think one of the factors that was causing me a problem was that, and that didn't get resolved until sort of my mid-20s, where most players now get that checked out when they're youngsters.
Yeah, it's another point about the support staff around the club,
absolutely.
Isn't it?
So all that kind of made a knock-on effect, and I just was either perennially injured. Oh, that was the other thing. Again, there was a crazy disciplinary system. You know, it had to be something to do with discipline with me. There was a crazy disciplinary system that was set up. It only lasted a year, I think, where they had this rollover effect. So if you got 3 bookings in the first 5 or 10 matches, you were given an extra suspension. If you then got another 2 bookings in the next 10 matches, you got even more punishment. And then if you got another 1 in the next, you know, so there's like a rollover punishment for people. And there were several of us who got 10 bookings, let's say, in 30 matches. And we were missing something like 8 to 10 games from suspension. And it was crazy. And so not only was I being injured, but I was also getting suspended. And I can remember one was a booking in a reserve game when I was on my way back, which meant that I ended up getting suspended. Those kind of things do seem to happen sometimes, but ultimately I think from that, where I was guilty of was then not being professional enough in my approach. When I talk about, you know, consistency is underpinned by a consistent mental approach, and my consistency wasn't right by that time, possibly affected by some of the disappointments and things that happened, and without the sort of backup of all the sports science that's around now, you know, my lifestyle was probably not conducive to keeping going and pushing on, which you have to do. And so, you know, physicality was starting to dip. Before you know where I was kind of touching 30. I mean, I had several injuries and all the rest of it, and struggling. Steve Bruce came in and was the manager, and I definitely have one of the consequences of that as a midfield player. It's, as you know, it's fundamental that they're physically as fit as anything, and that was something that had waned on me, and not just because of the injuries, but just physically. Then my legs were, I was struggling to get around the park like I needed to do. I could still play the game and read the game and all this of it, but and that's when I went to Livingston, because they were, what had happened with me the previous 2 or 3 seasons, I'd been very injury prone, and so what happens normally for clubs, you know, I think most clubs knew I was a decent player, but there was always question marks about injuries then. But Ray Stewart at Livingston, bless him, wanted to take a chance, and I often feel guilty for time. I think I was struggling with an ankle injury and one or two other things, and travelling up, I was living up in Livingston during the week and travelling back down to Halifax. And so there was a number of reasons why that didn't particularly work out. I only signed to the end of the season, and that was prior to going to Chesterfield. So not a massively enjoyable memory of Livingston. Funnily enough, I was speaking to Michael McBride, who's a physio at Wigan. He was the physio then. He's now, I think he's one of the physios at Scotland, and we were recollecting on this a few weeks ago. But it wasn't a great episode.
But yes, it was closer to home at Chesterfield that you wind down your playing career, and it's also where you moved into management. Was it always your intention to try your hand there, or was it just something that you fell into by being a senior player there? And
I think early, if you'd have asked me when I was a young lad, you know, I think it's a stock answer. We used to be then for lads who want to be footballers. You know, first you want to be a footballer, then they want to be a coach and a manager. So I probably would have said that, but throughout my career, probably would have been having second thoughts. So one of the reasons why I began the psychology degree when I was old, I think partly, again, that was in part because of my experiences at Aberdeen and previously, and also probably I was probably experiencing a bit of burnout by then. I think I'd played a lot of my, I think I played 450 games in my career. I probably played 300 of them at least by the time I was 23 or 24, you know.
Yeah.
So I played a lot of football and probably was feeling a little bit burnt out, which is often is something that happens, you know, to sportsmen and particularly footballers because of the performance demands, you know, which again is something that I wasn't aware of. The interest in psychology was personal in terms of my experiences, but it was also with an idea around what I might do next. I had this idea. There were people that had sort of been floating around in football. I remember Willie brought in a guy called Jack Black, not the Jack Black that's on the, you know, the film star, but the guy who was a kind of a motivational speaker. I was very interested in what he had to say, but most of the players, I think, were just, you know, bewildered and not really engaged. And I did have a sense that maybe when if I got qualified as a psychologist when I finished playing, that might be something. I felt passionately that was an area that was not being looked at properly and needed to be, and I think it's, you know, it still is, and it's obviously becoming more apparent now. But that was the thought around that time. But then the coaching stuff was more just because it was almost something that most people were doing as a way of giving yourself opportunities, you know, to get something after you finish. So in many ways I did fall into it because I was doing my badges whilst playing. And then eventually, Chesterfield as a football club had problems with an unscrupulous owner. They got quite well publicised. I was sort of there, and one of the sort of senior players, and I kind of, along with a couple of other senior players, almost guided the players through that period because it looked a bit dodgy for a time in terms of the club even being kicked out of the league for illegal, you know, all sorts of accusations of all sorts of things. And what happened was that the then manager Nicky Law left to go to Bradford and took his assistant with him, and the club weren't in any position to appoint anybody from outside the club, and asked the physio, a guy called Dave Rushby, to take over, who'd also been an ex-player. He asked me to help him as assistant because obviously I was probably the most experienced player at the club. So that's what happened, and then he eventually gave him the job and asked me to be his assistant. And then after about a year, I think he got the sack. I took over as caretaker, managed the club in Division 1. And then, but at the time, and in fairness, at the time, it was probably my most popular at Chesterfield. And I think most of the supporters would have been quite happy for me to get the manager job, even though at the time, it was not the vogue to give a 33-year-old or 34-year-old, whatever it was, the job. Obviously, nowadays, that's not seen as a barrier. But the chairman said that he wanted me to learn under an experienced manager, and he had a perfect person in place, and that he would give me the job after an apprenticeship, if you like, which I thought was, you know, sounded like a fair and plausible idea. So he brought Roy McFarland in, and I had 4 years of assisting Roy, who was a fantastic guy, a good manager, and learned a lot from him. And then the chairman was true to his word. Sadly, in Roy's last season, we actually got relegated from Division 1. And in many ways, the supporters were anti my appointment from that moment. They wanted to change it, and understandably so. Oh, when I say the supporters, you know, I'd say a fair, substantial number of them weren't happy. So it was always difficult, but we did okay. We should have done better. But my managerial experience came to an end after 2 years, and that was that. So now, after trying to get a job for a year, that's when I decided to put in place a plan B option.
Yeah, which was to focus more on the sports and performance psychology. But around about the time that you left Chesterfield, you did actually apply, at least it was in the press that you applied, for the manager's job at Aberdeen.
Yeah, probably did. Yeah, I think I remember speaking to Willie, because I think Willie was probably the director of football.
He would have been, yeah, yeah.
And just said, look, you know, and I to throw my hat into the ring, and I think he said, right, fine, do so, and that's it, I didn't hear anything else, so I can't remember who got the job at the time. Was it Stoff?
Mark McGee.
Mark McGee got it, right. Yeah. So, listen, I could understand that. From their point of view, managers often get appointed based on experience and their feeling from clubs that they...
Well, Lee, I can assure you, you certainly wouldn't have done, you wouldn't have been capable of doing any worse than Mark McGee did in his time up here, regardless of how you'd done. It couldn't have possibly gone any worse than Mark's time, unfortunately. Yeah. But, I'm really interested in what you're doing now, which is sports and performance psychology. So working a lot with footballers, with other sportsmen, you're working with the PFA or have worked with the PFA, working with Lancashire County Cricket Club as well.
That's right.
So... is it all just about trying to get them to overcome the mental hurdles that are in the way, like the sort of hang-ups that you thought you saw when you looked around that dressing room at Parkhead in 1993?
It's a huge area. It's essentially, psychology is the study of the human mind and human behaviour, if you like, which pretty much encapsulates everything. I think it's almost 50-50 split, I seem to experience, where there are, many people don't want to even engage with the idea of it and don't really want to think too deeply about what's going on, you know, in between the ears. And although they do in every day, you know, they kind of, in everyday speak, everybody's talking about psychology, whether they realise it or not. But then obviously there are lots of people who are interested in actually understanding things a little bit more. And with that understanding comes a better sense of, I think, of how to... you know, become more efficient, more consistent when it comes to football. Now, that's not to say that everybody who's consistent top performer has needed psychological help or anything like that. They probably just get it intuitively. All coaches and managers, big part of their army should be psychological strategies and abilities to motivate players, to understand them as individuals, to have positive relationships and to be able to influence people's emotion and what we call cognition, which is kind of focus and concentration, that sort of thing. So it's a huge, huge area that partly because people think they know more about it than anybody else because they know their own mind and they know what they know type thing. That's one of the reasons in football particularly why it's been resisted. In other sports, there's not such resistance. It's just in other sports, they pretty much see it just like a physiotherapist.
Yeah.
You know, they see it that, you know, when the human mind is the most complex system in the universe, it's not that strange to have somebody in an environment where pressure and performance is, you know, based or decided off on marginal factors. They don't see it as unusual to have or to make sure that they've always got access to somebody who might have some insight into that side of things. In football, bizarrely, traditionally, there's always been barriers to that sort of individual being involved at a football club. That's more down to sort of culture and climate that keeps self-perpetuating over time. It is changing. I think in England now we have something called the EPPP for the younger academies, which is instilling certain standards within the academies regarding support staff, one of which is there's kind of four tiers of academies, and there's certainly the top two are now expected to have psychological support for all young players coming through. My belief, honestly, is that at the senior level, there's a role for a sports psych or performance psych, whatever you want to call them, or psychologist, who, and there are several areas that they can help manage environment and the performance of players and staff, because often staff are actually forgotten in this, and staff in football and professional sport now are under lots of pressure, and many of them aren't paid the same sort of level of money that the players are, and but they've obviously trained long and hard to get qualifications to be able to work in professional sport. And as I've just found out in the last couple of weeks, my role at Wigan is now no more because the manager's been sacked, I would say very unfairly. And so now I'm looking for potentially another consultancy in that area. Mm-hmm. I'm hopefully able to sort of come to terms with that because of some of the experiences I've already had in this area and in others. But, there's lots of need for support within that environment. Actually, I would say right from the top, because some of the decision-making, some of the inability to cope with pressure and stress, if you like, from the highest level in football, cascades down, and lack of vision, lack of values, lack of all sorts of things, mean that it's a very toxic environment at times. And like you say, as you can probably tell, I'm quite passionate about it, but it's based on experience. It's not just based on that fact that I've, been on the outside of football and thought that some of these players could do some help. It's because I've actually been there as a player coming through, and I've witnessed that players do sometimes need a bit extra help. Managers need a bit extra help. Coaches need a bit extra help in terms of coping with the demands of what they need, or expected of them.
Yeah, it's a tremendously interesting field. The fact that you've worked with Lancashire County Cricket Club makes me think of, obviously, the cases of Jonathan Trott and Marcus Truscothick, both of whom really struggled with the demands of top-class international cricket, but were at least in an environment that they were able to come out and say that and address that, if perhaps belatedly. I'm not sure the same thing would be accepted in football, and I think you're right, football does tend to lag quite a bit behind. We spoke about burnout before, but young players' burnout, and that you may have been subject to that. Well, a lot of the guys that played under Alex Ferguson for Aberdeen were very young guys, and subsequently didn't go on to have the sort of stellar careers that they perhaps should have, their talent suggested they should have done, because they played so much football at such a young age. And again, something that even now I don't think we quite understand the effects of in football.
No, it's a very, very good point. And the thing to really, I think what I'd like to really stress is that actually my focus is on performance. This is the misunderstanding. And actually, I think where most awareness needs to be raised is that in any walk of life, whether you're in a professional footballer or you're a businessman or you're a whatever you do, life's events can cause significant pressures and demands that come on unexpectedly. The pressures of actually performing at a high level in any area brings its own stresses and strains. There's actually a cyclical continuum between positive, if you like, high-level performance and sort of mental health and well-being issues that often occur on the back of prolonged stress. And it's a continuum. And, just because individuals are performing at a high level in any industry or any walk of life, it does not immune them temporary, more often than not, temporary episodes of either stress-related issues, depression, anxiety. So there are mental health issues, certain mental health issues that are kind of structural and genetic, mm-hmm. that the majority of us, thankfully, won't ever experience. But the majority of us are all vulnerable to those kind of challenges. And the sort of ignorant approach, or the "it'll never happen to me," or "it only ever happens to weak people," is just bonkers, and actually is contradictory to the fact that most people who are and do have experienced tough times can recover very quickly with some help and some guidance. And that's really the tragedy of it over the years. That people have lost their lives because of the stigma around some issues like mental health, because of not seeking help when it's needed. I mean, that's one of my main focuses. Now is, I have a business I've developed two online platforms that basically look at both ends of this continuum. The PFA use one of them for all the academies. In fact, next week I'm speaking to all the coaches throughout the country in the Football League, discussing this side of it. But the performance side of it is just as important in terms of thinking about in the round. You know, like I was saying earlier, my own attitude towards my career as a player contributed my own downfall. So my ego grew too big because of obviously some of the successes that I had. There are so many players that have no idea that they are going down the wrong road. There's some very high profiles now I could name that you probably would be able to see yourself that, you know, are not going to maximise their potential because their egos are getting in the way or their behaviours are getting in the way. But unfortunately, many of those people are almost untouchable for someone like myself because of this, again, this stigma, this idea that, that your mental approach is unchallengeable. Consistency is based on a consistent mental approach, and that means examining all areas and actually being open to it. So, you know, it's a passion of mine, probably partly because of my own experiences, and, we'll see what happens in the future. But, you know, I do agree with you. I think football does lag behind, and in terms of just seeing this as an area that is not just an add-on. And that's what I was told by the chief executive at Wigan recently, that, you know, they're going to have to let me go because obviously Gary brought me to the club, and, you know, when the money's tight, they would just see it as an add-on that's not an essential part. Now, you know, there are some clubs who do see psychology as an essential part of what they do, and hopefully that will be the case in years to come, but we'll have to wait and see.
Well, yes, it's a fascinating topic for discussion, and certainly I think it's something that will soon be seen as part of the wider suite of support services for footballers. It'll just be de rigueur amongst all football clubs. I just want to end the conversation, Lee, by talking about another of your passions. We touched on them earlier. Obviously, when you were up in Aberdeen, you were almost as much renowned for your drumming with One God Universe as you were for your midfield skills. Are you still a part-time drummer?
Yeah, well, funnily enough, bizarrely, hot off the press, I actually went pratting with my... basically, when I left Chesterfield, very quickly, when I left Chesterfield, I got involved with... My son was playing for the local football team, and it was an end-of-year presentation, and so several of the dads who were at the football club were all sort of keen amateur musicians, and there was this idea that we were going to have, like, a dad's band for the presentation night. Of which I got asked to a practice where there were several guys. It was a bit like X Factor, you know, gone badly wrong. There were several of us, and I was left with two guys. One was a double bass player, and one was a guitarist called Spud, who I'd known from school. Anyway, we were kind of the last three picks, you know. As it turns out, the guy who's a double bass player is an extraordinary musician who sings and plays the double bass. But all they wanted was like a monkey at the back to keep banging the beat out. So I sort of joined him. And anyway, we played, and frankly for us, there were two or three of the dad bands that went down quite poorly. They were kind of slightly embarrassing, but we were actually pretty good. And everybody kind of really liked us. We then played a gig for the lead singer's wife's 40th. And lo and behold, we became a band called the Weed Whackers. We were called the Weed Whackers, which relates to the strings on a double bass, not anything else. And, so I was with the Weed Whackers for a few years, actually. A couple of incarnations. The lead singer left, and another one came. And then when I was at West Ham, in the third season at West Ham, I was sort of more or less there full-time, so I had to sort of give it up back in 2013, it would be. So I kind of gave up my stool for the Weavers, which was a very hard thing to do because I absolutely loved it. Anyway, in recent weeks, I've been asked by the double bass player to go back because the drummer they've got is playing in other bands, etc. It's a long-winded story, but what I'm going to get to is that... So I actually had my first practice with the Weed Whackers on Wednesday night and really enjoyed it. So it looks like I'm back with the band. So yes, I am bashing away again.
Excellent.
Still keep in touch with Gordon Smith, who's my sort of... guru who taught me lots that I know, and still like the Alone God Universe. But I listened to the album a few months ago and I thought, you know what, I still can't believe it didn't go global.
Yeah,
there we go.
It could have. One final thing, and I want you to do a bit of myth-busting here if you can, Lee, but footballers are renowned for having the worst music taste in the world. Yourself accepted, but is that generally the rule in the dressing rooms you've been in?
You know, I changed isn't it? Because the music's changed now. I mean, going back to my obviously AOR, adult orientated rock was the, you know, was most footballers' kind of choice. I have to say, you know, one of my Alec and I, Alec McLeish, were big early Genesis fans. I have to hate
We had Alex on the show, and he actually told us a story about going to see Genesis in Aberdeen with Steve Archibald and having a Dodge Fergie, because the gig was on a Friday night, and he turned around and he saw that Fergie was in the row behind him. It was a fabulous story.
Really? That's brilliant. Yeah, we and Alec went to see them in Edinburgh, but you know, I like all sorts of music, also ranging from, the kind of heaviest, loudest rock, you know, Rammstein and bands like that, and to people like Busta Rhymes on the other side of the spectrum, and classical music. Like, you know, there's good music and bad music for me, and the range between. So, but in terms of your analysis of footballers, there's a lot of them now that are into rap, and don't get me wrong, there's some good rap, but there's a lot of it is just repetitive crap. And, so yeah, I mean. I like all sorts of music and listen to all sorts of music.
Lee, on that note, thank you very much for your time this morning. It's been a real privilege for us. It would be great if you could make it back up to Aberdeen for a game at some point. I know that the supporters would love to see you again. But thank you very much for speaking to us.
No problem, Richard. Thank you.
So there we are. The drum bashing, referee antagonising, midfield enforcer that was Lee Richardson. As we mentioned during a conversation with Lee, our thanks to John McLeish for putting us in touch, and clearly, our thanks to Lee himself for being so generous with his time. Do join us next time on the By the Minute podcast for the best discussion on the Dons each week. Or, if you enjoyed today's show, check out some of our past interviews with other ex-Pittodrie stars, available from iTunes or the By the Minute website. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.